Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to the show. Thank you for being here. I love you guys. I'm gonna start expressing my love more. By the way, my guest today is the hilarious Rob Reiner, who you have to love. Rob Reiner. He's made some of the best movies. Princess Bride, Stand By Me, Spinal Tap. Huh? A Few Good Men, pretty fucking good. He was on All in the Family, but he's a great guy who I was very excited to talk to, who I'd never met before, who I met for the first time the day before he was supposed to come over here at the Gary Shandling Memorial that I told you I was going to. What an amazing, beautiful event that was. The place was just filled with people that knew Gary. And, you know, I told you guys, I didn't know Gary that well. The experience I had with him was really limited to parking his car once at the Comedy Store when I was 22 and having the interview I had in here with him that Judd Apatow helped facilitate, because, you know, Judd and I have become pretty close. And Judd put together, I might drop a few names talking about this beautiful event. It's not really my nature, but it's sort of important to put it into context. Judd put together this amazing event with film footage from Gary's childhood and footage from his television career, you know, bits and pieces of things. And he had he sort of was the host of the event, and there was music, and there was people recollecting and reflecting on Gary. One of his Buddhist monk friends from the monastery and community that he helped support and fund spoke, and the love, man, the love. Like, I guess what I'm saying is I didn't really know Gary, but after, you know, spending 2.5 hours with these people speaking about him, who loved him, and talking about his life and his journey to be open and to be in the present and to be his authentic self, was it really changed my life a little bit. It was weird. Like, I felt like when I left the service, it's a somber event, but it was right from the get-go a celebration of Gary Shandling's life. And it was stunning. I mean, should I walk you through it? I feel like I should, because it was really beautiful. You walk into this big theater, and Jeff Goldblum is just sitting on stage playing jazz piano. You know, as people walk in, and they're showing slides and pictures of Gary. And then the lights go down, and Ryan Adams, Johnny Depp, Don Was, and I don't know who the piano player was, they take the stage and do a song. I think it was maybe a Ryan Adams song. I think it was called Wrecking Ball or something along those lines. And they play that, and they walk off. And then Judd comes up and opens the show with an emotional sort of reflection on Gary. But it was funny. These are funny people. So there was always some humor running through it. And it was just, you know, one after the other, people that work with Gary, some people, you know, some of his close friends. They did a sketch at the very beginning where Hank or Jeffrey Tambor and Penny Johnson Gerald, who played Beverly, did a little bit. That was very funny. They did that in character. And then, yeah, Judd comes up. And it was just so many different people and so many different video montages. It was just stunning. And there was music. You know, E from the Eels went up and played a song called Motherfucker, I believe might have been the name of the song. Adam Sandler closed it out by doing My Sweet Lord, the George Harrison song, with John Bryan and Don Was again. And it was just astounding and really moving and made me want to live a better life. And I guess that's the best you can ask from a reflection of someone else's life. It was just great. Now, if I can get to the other part, it was very hard for me because it was a somber event, but we knew we were there to celebrate Gary, and we these were show business people and funny people. So there's a lot of people there, and I'm kind of a fucking fanboy. I don't know if you know this about me. Perhaps if you listen to this show, you certainly know that I do tend to do that. But I'm overwhelmed, and I love, you know, actors and comedians and musicians. I just love them. Like it's amazing. Like it's very hard for me even now after talking to so many of them and being in their presence and realizing they're just people. They're still sort of mythic to me. And I know right away that they're just people, but there's some part of me that's still like, yeah, that like Judd kind of told me to sit right up front. So I sat right up front with my buddy, Jerry Stahl. It was next to Mark Everett from the Eels. And then right over from Jerry, like two seats down, Tom Petty sits down. And it's like, he was cool. I introduced myself. And even though he seemed like a sweet guy, just a regular person, but it's fucking Tom Petty. I'm at a memorial service, but I'm inside. I'm like, Tom Petty's right there. Tom Petty's right fucking there. Oh, this is sad. But Tom Petty's right there. All right, they're starting. So, you know, there was that element happening for me because I don't go to these things and I don't really feel like I'm in show business most of the time, you know, because I work here in the garage and I do my show, but I don't think that anyone watches it. Premieres on IFC May 4th, by the way, the new season of Marin. But it was really incredible, the emotions that were there. But also, like, I met some people and I don't know if it's wrong of me to talk about it because I wasn't there to meet people, but right behind me, Annette Bening and Warren Beatty were sitting. And, you know, I just turned around and I didn't know they were there. And I'm looking right at Warren Beatty and I choked. I was like, hi, how are you? Mark Maron. Hi, Warren, right? Well, of course. And I couldn't even look at him. I couldn't even hold eye contact. And then Annette Bening, this was really the, you know, outside of the emotions that were going on with the memorial, this was before, you know, Annette Bening said she liked this show and that her daughter loved the show and gets a lot out of the show. So this is what I'm telling you. For years, I thought like, you know, my father, you know, I talked about my father at his father's funeral and he was a little too chipper, you know, for a funeral. But I realized, like, you know, when you don't see all these people, or you don't know all these people, and you're around certain people and you're excited, it's a weird combination of feelings. You know, I was so excited to see all these people that I have such respect for and that I'm fans of, that it was, you know, it was sort of counterintuitive to what was supposed to be a somber event, but turned out to be a beautifully deep and hilarious and well-balanced and enlightening night. And it was all very sweet because it really was a celebration. It was a horrible thing that happened, but you know, in the wake of it, literally, you have this amazing celebration of someone's life with real emotions. And Kevin Nealon was just astounding. He went up there and he did, you know, a piece of that he had written that was obviously hilarious, but he had somehow built the piece to sort of handle his emotions because they were very close and he got very emotional. But the comedy that he was doing, the piece that he was doing, the stories he was telling, the jokes he was doing, was what they sort of built as his emotions built. And it seemed as if that he intertwined them intentionally so he could have the feelings that he was having yet still be funny. It was something like I'd never seen before. It was so impressive and beautiful. And Adam Sandler, who, you know, I don't think he knows me really or likes me necessarily, but he did such a sweet, beautiful job on the George Harrison song, singing it earnestly. Anyways, it was really a beautiful thing, and I'm so glad I went. And Gary Schelling's going to be missed, but I'll tell you, I learned some lessons just from listening to people talk about him and his life. Just, it was beautiful. It was beautiful. And I'm thinking out loud here, people. I'm just thinking out loud. Like, a lot of you have been with me through a lot of stuff over the last 6 or 7 years. And this is sort of the next phase. You know, how do I engage my feelings in my life? I got this beautiful email from a guy after the monologue about empathy and love and grief and whatnot. This just came in. Subject line, your show helped me today, from Chad. He said, hey, Mark, I've been listening for a while. And this is, I'd be honest with you, these kind of emails, I had no idea that my life would be so rich as to to have this effect on people's lives. And the gratitude and humility that I'm able to experience from the feedback, it's just like, it's so great. It's better than anything. It's better than money. It's better than you know, being known, any of that shit. To sort of like, you know, to reach out and connect. Hey, Mark, I've been listening for a while. I love your show. You're amazing at it, and I'm always entertained by it, and I usually get something from each episode. Today, though, today was different. My dog, Teddy, has been battling cancer for almost a year. He lost a leg to it. He almost died in surgery, and he's had to wear a cone and deal with the pain this whole time. And you know what? He's been awesome through it all. No whining. He bounces back every time he needs something done, and he hasn't let it dampen his spirits. He's a special little guy, and he touches people. The vets all love him. People on the street stop and pet him and give him belly rubs. People across the street come to see Teddy, and after that, more often than not, they tell us how amazing he is and how lucky we are to have him. But my girlfriend and I found out yesterday that the cancer is spreading, and it's not treatable. He's fought hard, but it's too much for him, and that breaks my heart. I don't know how I'm going to deal with it when the time comes. Today, the day after I found out the horrible news, I listened to your Steve-O episode, 701, number 701, and the intro hit me. It hit me hard. Because of you and what you said, I'm feeling this grief. I'm feeling all of it, and it's a terrible feeling to feel. I usually shut out my emotions. I'm the man's man that doesn't cry, but I'm bawling today, off and on. I don't care anymore. And listening to your show made me okay with it. I'm going to cry now when I need to, and I'm going to feel all of this and love him in the time he has instead of distancing to make it hurt less. Your show did that. Your show did this to me. It allowed me to open up and be emotional in a way I haven't in at least 30 years. After your intro, I stopped and went to the restroom at work, and I cried for about 10 minutes. But you know what? When I came back and started the interview, I laughed. And I haven't laughed in a little while, but I did today. Your podcast helps. It helped me a lot. It's opened me up emotionally. It's pointed out flaws I didn't know I had. Your intros have made me a better person, and your interviews have opened me up to other points of view and to the interconnectedness and shared experience of life. I wanted you to know the difference it made and to say thank you, Mark. Thank you, Chad. P.S. I'm going to include a picture of Teddy just so you can see. This is our special little guy, and there's a picture of this sweet, sweet dog. And I'm sorry you're going through that, Chad, and thank you for the email. See, this is what I'm learning, and also was sort of an undercurrent of a lot of what people were saying about channeling and about what's important in life. I'm starting to feel that. Now that I'm not spinning out all the time in fear, I'm starting to realize, and I think you guys realized it ahead of me, that, you know, this is what life is having these kind of connections, you know, sharing this kind of stuff with people and having an impact on each other's lives through the human experience, not through distancing ourselves from it, trying to get past the panic and desperation and entitlement and self-centeredness and that kind of stuff. Now, this isn't going to turn into some spiritual show. Did I mention I was sitting like almost right next to Tom Petty? Did I mention that? And I talked to Annette Bening. Did I mention that? She likes the show. It's still about that too. And it's still about funny, right? Right? Some most days, right? All right. So I watched Rob Reiner's new film that his son co-wrote about his son's experience, based on his son's experience with addiction and rehab and some of Rob's experience as well. And we kind of talked about that a bit. That movie's called Being Charlie. It comes out on May 6th. As I said, it was co-written by his son, Nick Reiner. And this is me and Rob Reiner. I had a lovely time talking to him. I got a real kick.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Out of him.
How long were you in Albuquerque?
I was there from third grade to through high school, and my father's still there.
So you get down there a lot?
Not much. You know, I wish I got along better with him, and I felt compelled to go.
Then you'd want to go.
Exactly.
It was like the thing we saw when we were at the Gary Shandling Memorial.
Right.
You know, and with his mother.
I thought that was an amazing thing. It was hard for me, I think, on some level, I felt a little embarrassed because I don't know if I act appropriately because I don't go to those things. Not that there's many of them necessarily, but... Yeah.
But they're going to be more and more.
I know.
Mark, as we go along.
I know. But I get so excited to see everybody, and I'm always amazed when people know me because I'm like, you know, I'm this outlier. And so I see you talking to Billy Crystal, and I'm like, oh, my God, it's Rob Reiner and Billy Crystal. And Billy Crystal, and I'm acting like it's a wake, but I'm, yeah. I'm like, oh, this is terrific.
Yeah. Well, inappropriate. I mean, that's what's terrible, too, is you know, people that you know and you hang out with and stuff. And then you see them, and that's in those circumstances, you know?
And as you get older, you don't see people as much anymore.
No, that's true. And why do you think that is?
Time and...
I think it has to do, I really believe, you know, that whole thing they say where you're born alone, you die alone, that bit.
Yeah.
Well, I think what happens as you get older, you start thinking about, that.
Yeah.
And also that... You don't want to spend any time with anybody that's going to annoy you or make it uncomfortable. And as you get older, you realize that there are more and more people that annoy you. So you limit. Your world keeps narrowing and getting narrower.
And this happens at a subconscious level or a conscious level?
I think it's unconscious. I don't think you're consciously saying, I think I'm going to narrow my world now. No, you think... You know, I don't really like that person that much. So why should I stay? You know, it's like when you're young, you never leave a movie theater until the movie's over.
Right.
Now you go, I don't really like, why do I have to watch the last hour of this piece of crap? You know, because I have such a limited time on the planet.
But also you get up earlier when you get older. That's killing me.
That's like, true. What the fuck is that?
I think it's God saying this. You're running out of time.
Yeah.
You better take a couple more hours today.
Yeah. But then it takes longer to pee.
Mm-hmm.
So you maybe that's why you have to get up earlier, because you got to factor in all the time it takes to pee.
I pee. I get up all night and pee. I don't know. You don't do that?
I do. I think I get up, you know, two or three times a night, and then I can't go back to sleep.
Right. Yeah. But the annoying thing, though, I don't know, we're all kind of annoying. I mean, if you really think of your friends, I mean, who are they?
Yeah.
You know, and I guess it's just who you can tolerate. And also, I think you have family stuff, you have work stuff. And now with phones and computers, it's like all the time is eaten up, unnecessarily eaten up.
Yes. And you trick yourself into believing
that
you're actually either working or communicating with people.
Right.
You know, I'm texting, I'm emailing, I'm doing. You're not talking to anybody.
Exactly.
Talking to a computer.
Right. And actually talking to people is like it's
like
exhausting.
We're doing now.
It becomes exhausting.
It is exhausting.
If you could text somebody, it's like,
oh boy,
I'm
gonna
talk to that guy.
I'm so happy to not have to talk to him. Yeah. So, but I look at the Gary Shandling thing last night, and I'm thinking, you know, look at all the friends he had and all the people who he was close to.
I know.
People, and I'm saying, is that true?
Yeah.
Is that true? Or
well, I don't know. Like, I only met him once when I talked to him in here, and I was always a fan, you know, and I'm friends with Apatow. So I don't know, but I was sort of amazed. Like these people, he sounded like he was like a mentor, a Buddha, and a guy that he sounds like he wasn't doing the work that everyone gets hung up on, but instead he was just sitting around talking to people about what they were working on.
Yeah, and he's helping Sarah Silverman, and he's helping
everybody,
and helping Apatow.
It seems like that basketball game was the foundation of modern show business.
Yeah, I know. My wife kept saying, "How come we don't have anything like that? You just like to sit in your room. You don't do anything. You gotta. Why can't we have people come?" I said, "Because I don't like any of these people."
Why? Not that I don't want to speak out of school or anything, but I had Gary Marshall in here the other day.
Yeah, Gary, he's a great guy.
And there's a couple of people have said that you had the best parties.
We did
at your house
when you were
married to Penny.
Yes, it's true. When I was married to Penny, it was like a fraternity house. I mean, we had, you know, it was Albert Brooks and Louise Lasser and Jim Brooks and John Belushi.
Yeah.
And everybody and Chevy and everybody came to the house.
So you
and
did that?
Yeah, I did it. But that's when you're young.
Right.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
You look at this show like Friends, right? Friends, the show Friends.
It's so funny.
And you've got all these people.
Yeah.
They're in their, I guess, their 20s or something.
Right.
And they're hanging out with each other. And I guess that's what you do. You go in packs. But when you get into your 30s, your 40s, your 50s, you don't do that anymore.
You got kids.
You got kids. You hang out with them. And then when you get older, you don't have that, hey, let's go and hang out at the coffee shop. They don't do it.
Maybe you get one guy.
Yeah, one guy.
I mean, I talked to your father. I was at the house you grew up in, I think.
Yeah.
I went over there.
That's why Jerry has comedians in cars going for coffee.
Right.
Because the fact of the matter is, if he didn't have that show, he wouldn't be with anybody.
Yeah, I don't.
You know, this is his opportunity to get out of the house and hang out with
somebody. That's right. And that's why I think he goes on the road to get out of the house.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like he needs money.
No, he doesn't need it. He just likes to do it.
Yeah, I never understand that. You know, you see these guys that have $1 billion. It's like, why are you doing anything?
Yeah, because they like to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Or if they don't do it, they're just sitting around going, when am I going to die?
Yeah.
When does this happen?
Yeah.
But, you know, I went to your father's house, and he says he hangs out with Mel every night.
Mel and my dad every single night.
Really? Every night?
Yeah, virtually every night.
That's really something.
Listen, it's wonderful that they have each other. They met each other when they were in their 20s doing shows. And to have that kind of bond and that bond to stick, and they make each other laugh. They enjoy each other's company. They both lost their spouses recently, so they have that. And they say that, you know, they watch any movie that has Secure the Perimeter in it. They watch it.
Do you go over there? Do you?
Yeah, I've been over there. I was over there one time when they got into a huge fight over it was an appearance that Mel did on the Carson show, and they were arguing about, it was like the Sunshine Boys.
Yeah.
They're arguing about who got the, you know, which line got the biggest laugh. And Mel was a guy who was played an expert on wine.
Yeah.
He could detect any wine. And they blindfolded him. They gave him a glass of wine. He tasted it. And he went, I think it's a red. It's a Cabernet. It's 1970. And Carson says, No, that's not. It's not. He says, okay, wait a minute. Let me try. He takes another sip. Oh, yes, it's a red. It's a Bordeaux. It's a 1983. No, it's not that. He says, all right, let me taste it in. Okay, I got it. It's a white. And that was a big laugh. And then Mel says, that's the line that got the big laugh. And I said, no. My dad says, no, it was the line after that. It was the line after it. He takes another sip and he says, oh, I know what it is. It's Chiclets. And that got a big laugh too. And Mel said, no, but the white wine got the bigger. My dad says, yes, but it's not as funny as the Chiclets, because here's a guy who was a wine expert who couldn't tell the difference between a liquid and a solid. That's the funny part. So they yelling at each other.
And you're sitting there.
I'm
watching
sitting there.
That?
I'm loving it. Yeah.
Well, you know, who else did I talk to? Norman Lear I talked to.
Yeah.
And he said about you. That like, I guess you vacation with his family or you live somewhere.
Here's the thing. My dad and mom used to go with a group of other people. There were the five families. It's not like the Italians. It was Larry Gelbart and his wife, Pat,
mm-hmm.
Norman Lear
and
Francis,
Dom
DeLuise and Carol, and Mel Brooks and Ann Bancroft. And my folks would go and they would rent a house together. And they called it Yenemvelt.
Yeah.
For those of you who are not Jewish, it means heaven, the other side.
Yeah,
you know, when you die, you go to heaven, Yenemvelt.
That's what happened.
Have fun.
Like,
they have fun. It's, you know, five Jewish families sitting around making each other laugh. So that's what they did. Now, the fact is, I used, as a kid, used to go over to Norman Lear's house all the time. And he was actually the first person that ever thought I was funny.
Right, that's what he said. He said you had the demeanor of an old Jewish man at like seven.
Yes, absolutely. I was playing, I don't remember it, but I was playing jacks with his daughter. We were about seven or eight. And I was saying, no, here's what you do. You don't pick the ball up. You put the thing. And I was doing all that.
Yeah.
And Norman thought it was funny. And he told my dad, he says, your son is really funny. And my father says, that kid? No. That brooding kid that sits in the corner, he's so sad.
Not funny.
No, not funny. But and then I finally bought Norman Lear's house.
Really?
Yes. Well, it was actually Henry Fonda's house.
Oh, yeah? Initially. Is that where you live now?
Yeah.
Well, that's years later.
Many years later. Yeah.
At nine.
Yeah, nine, and then about 30 years later.
Bought the house.
32, yeah.
It's funny, your father, You just said you were the brooding kid.
I was.
But you talk to your father, and within seconds, it'll be my son's friend, Albert.
Yes.
The funniest guy I've ever seen in my life.
He was the funniest. And Albert was a prodigy. At age 16.
A comedy prodigy?
Yes, a comedy prodigy. At age 16, he could make not just adults laugh,
yeah,
but professional, I mean, you know, world-class professional comedians.
Yeah.
My dad, Mel, he'd make them laugh at age 16. It was an amazing thing.
Yeah, he said he used to do a shtick in the curtain in the living room.
What he did was he played the greatest escape artist, greater than Houdini. And he basically said, here, just... he took a napkin and you just draped it over his hands. He said, it's good enough. Like, it was not even tied.
Yeah.
And he put a thing in his mouth, you know, just a napkin in his mouth, and he went behind the drapes. There was nothing. And all you heard from behind the drapes is, help! I can't breathe! I can't breathe! He had nothing to stop his hands from taking the napkin out of his nose and out of his mouth, and he could just walk out from behind the drapes. I can't breathe! That was it.
That was the bit? Yeah,
that was the bit.
And you guys have been friends since you were what?
Since we were 16.
That's crazy,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
and you're still friends now?
Yeah.
He came up to me last night, you know, because he won't come on the show.
He won't?
No.
Why?
Because I don't know. You tell
me. You
know
why? Because you don't pay him. That's why.
Really? Is that it?
I think that's it.
It's not because he doesn't like to talk about himself?
No. He's happy to talk. He just doesn't want to waste all that good comedy.
You know? What do you think it would take?
I don't know.
A limo and $500?
I don't know. But he's brilliant. He is.
No, I know. I like him.
He's the most brilliant. Very, yeah. And here's what's weird.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got Carl Reiner
and
Mel Brooks.
Right.
You've got Rob Reiner and Albert Brooks.
That's hilarious.
And also Jim Brooks, mm-hmm. who's also a friend. And then my son, Nick Reiner, is best friends with Joey Brooks, who's Mel Brooks's, Jim Brooks's son.
Really?
So you got three generations of Reiners and Brooks, and all the Reiners are Reiners, and none of the Brookses are Brookses. You've got Mel is Kaminsky,
right.
Jim is Bernstein, and...
really?
Yes.
That's funny. Who was the third
one? Albert is Einstein, yeah.
Everyone changed. They like Brooks. That fit. Not Jewish, not too goyish.
Yeah, exactly. It can kind of...
It's in the middle.
Yeah.
I just did the fourth season of my show on IFC, and I worked with Sally Struthers for one episode. And she had lovely things to say about you.
Oh, that's nice.
You see, in my fantasy world, because I don't consider myself to be actually in show business, I think you guys... You guys just talk to each other all the time. I still I'm like, you got to call once a week, right? No,
no, you don't.
Even you spend all the years on television.
No. I mean, you know, you listen, when you're doing a show like that, 8 years, you're as intimate as you're going to get.
You're
a family.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you move your different ways and you go on to different things.
No hard feelings.
You know, we are. We're like every time I make a movie, I feel like we're a traveling circus.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You go from one town to the next.
Yeah.
You're packed together.
Yeah.
And then you're on to the next thing.
Well, what kind of director are you? Nice guy?
I'm pretty nice. I'm pretty good. I like to have a nice set. I like to have a nice experience because I figured this out early on, but I really understand it now, is it's all about the time you have on the planet.
Right.
So if it's horrible and crappy and terrible, then that's all you have. So... Might as well have a nice, fun experience, and maybe you'll make a good movie, maybe you won't, but at least the time you're spending is, you're enjoying it.
Well, I just watched the most recent one that they sent me that I guess the reason why we got you today was the Charlie movie, Being Charlie.
Being Charlie, yeah.
Now, the backstory on that is your son co-wrote it,
right.
You directed it,
right.
And it was based somewhat on your son's experience?
Yes. My son, when he was 15 years old, started having problems with drugs.
Yeah.
And as parents, your first, your first charge is to keep your children safe. And so I didn't know what to do. Michelle didn't know what to do. We didn't know what to do. So he went into different, you know, programs, rehab programs in wilderness and different places. And none of it worked for him. It just, you know, he'd come out, he'd relapse, he'd come out, he'd relapse. And as he was doing this, one of the last places he went was this place, Promises. He met this guy, Matt Alisafin, who's one of the writers on the film. And they started writing about what their experiences had been and what they had gone through.
Uh-huh.
And when he got out and he was now doing better and feeling good, and then now he's 19, he started writing with Matt. He wrote a half hour, which was a funny, but it wasn't really touching any of the really deep things. And I said, you know, Nick, you could go a little deeper with this. Why don't you try? And he tried, and he did an hour comedy drama, and we tried to sell it. We couldn't. And then I said, you know, maybe you can make a film out of this, because I think there's something in here about not only what you went through, but how it affected your mom and dad and how it affects. So we started working on it together. And over the period of like a year, we came up with this thing. And it was like, it was the most personal thing I've ever been involved in, because, I mean, we're dealing with, you know, his relationship to me and what he went through. And I'm learning more and more, and learning probably the stuff I should have known early on that would have helped me help him a little bit more. And it brought us very much closer together. And we made this film. And I think it's, you know, it's one of the most emotional and satisfying creative experiences I've ever had.
That's a great story. And, you know, I got like 16 years sober, and I was sort of, whenever I see it depicted, on television or in a movie, I'm not critical, but I'm like, let's see if they get it.
Yeah.
And you got it. You know, you got the part of it that is, you got that relentless, unexplainable nature.
Yeah.
Of the disease of addiction.
Yeah.
And like, you know, I'm watching that thing. I watched it all last night, and my brain, and God knows you must know that, it, just in general, there's some part of you that's like, it's going to be a happy ending. Yeah, the girl, he's going to get the girl. And it's not an unhappy ending, but it's a difficult.
Yeah, it's a tough ending, but it's a hopeful.
It's hopeful and honest.
It's hopeful and honest as he is going to struggle. His relationship isn't perfect with his father, but it's better than it was, and it's going to get better. And he's off on his own trying to make his way in the world and do the best he can. It doesn't mean that that kid never relapses.
Sure, or, right.
You know, I mean, that's part of what you have to go through.
But that's a ballsy way to end a movie.
Yeah. Well, it's honest. It's honest. And you know what's interesting, Mark, is that, you know, when we were working on it, the first draft, he was like, the father character was like an asshole. I mean, he was just a balls out asshole.
Yeah.
And I said to Nick, knowing how he had felt about me, you know, back then.
Yeah, I couldn't see you being that.
No, we have a good relationship now, and it's gotten way better, and it keeps getting better. And I said to him, just as a filmmaker, I said, you know, you can't have a character who's, you know, so one-dimensional. You
right.
gotta, if it's going to be interesting, you've got to make it, you know, three-dimensional for all the sides. And he's like, yeah, but the guy's a prick. He's a prick. He's not a good guy. And as the thing progressed, that was tough for me to hear, but as the thing progressed, he came to me at one point. He says, you know, Dad, I think the father is a little bit too much of an asshole. We've got to make him a little bit more. I said, okay, let's try, you know. And but this was as our relationship was changing. And then the last scene in the movie, which is, like you say, it's not all roses. And, you know, we changed that scene 100 times while we were making the film, right up till the day we shot it. And that always reflected how things were moving in terms of our relationship.
Well, so I imagine you got closer to him.
Oh, yeah.
During this process?
Absolutely.
Like, I couldn't see you being as much of a cold guy as the guy.
I wasn't. But I had to be strong, at least to what they told me.
Sure,
And it's not my nature.
Yeah.
My nature is not to be
the
authoritarian, you know, tough love guy. I'm not that kind of guy.
Yeah, you don't
But
feel
they
that
told
way.
Me that all these, like we say in the movie, everybody with a desk and a diploma tells me, you got to do this because otherwise you're...
You got to detach with love.
And it was hard. I couldn't do... I mean, I had a hard time. Now, I'm learning a little bit more about what his situation is, and I can be more of who I am.
And he's doing good?
Yeah, he's doing good.
How many kids you got?
I have 3.
Yeah?
He's the middle one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? And you have an older one?
I have an older one who's 20. He's going to be 25.
Show business?
He's a broadcast journalist.
Oh, okay.
And he works in Houston. Uh-huh. He's on the air a couple times.
Oh, yeah?
Times a day, yeah.
And what's the younger one do?
And the younger one is just, she's 18. She's just graduating high school and going off to college next fall.
It's exciting.
Yeah. I'm the empty nest now. Yeah. So my wife has the, you know.
Oh, she's got the
stuck.
Full.
Yeah, she's stuck with me.
This is where it begins.
Yeah.
The real challenge.
Yes, yeah. It is.
I know.
It is.
I know, because they're like, you know, that, like, my brother's going through it a little bit. His kid just went off to college, and one of them's away at school, and he's like, so now what?
Yeah.
When you're
married, we're married now 27, you have all these distractions, the kids, the things, the thing, and then all of a sudden, oh, it's you?
Yeah. Do I like you?
I like you. I love you. And then, but what we're discovering is that we do like each other.
That's really good.
Do. Yeah, yeah.
That's a nice thing
and
to
realize. And we like to hang with each other.
To realize.
Yeah,
that's
her
in the house, right?
That's her in the house. Look, if she didn't like me, she wouldn't drive all the way to Glendale or wherever the fuck we are, Eagle Rock.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
She came here with me.
Yeah, I hope she's not disappointed.
Well, I hope not.
If I have to bring her in, I'll show her the Obama's cup or something.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very honored the fact that I'm sitting in the same place that Barack Obama sat.
Oh, yeah. It's great. It's great to have you. I would have had you before, but you wouldn't have known that it was a thing. You would have got the offer and you would have been like, what is this?
I asked you last night at the thing. I said, has the fact that Barack Obama been on your show, has that elevated
I can get Rob Reiner. it's a big break for me.
Yeah, I get it. No, but I would imagine it does help. I mean, it legitimizes in
well,
a way.
It makes people aware of the medium. Like, I think a lot of people, not even of a certain age, but they, you know, you go on these media junkets or whatever, for years people would come up here and go, what the fuck is this? Where am I? Yeah. Am I in television? Is it going to be television? Do we just talk? Who are you? Is this your house? And now, like, the difference is like, so this is where Obama was. That's the difference.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They put it on the map a little
bit. See, that's the other thing that's good is you bring the people into your garage.
Yeah.
And you just start talking.
Yeah, what else are you supposed to do?
Well, I know.
There's no pomp and circumstance.
I know. Well, there's a little pomp, but very little circumstance. I saw some pomp sitting over there.
Yeah, in the cat box.
Yeah,
yeah. There's a little bit.
Yeah, you should clean that
I gotta
out a
clean
bit.
The pomp out of the cat box. So, all right, so let's go back then. You started as an actor. Now, when you, because I'm fascinated with the world that you guys grew up in, because as time goes on, I realize that show business was a fairly intimate business, and that, you know, your father's generation, you know, there were a few studios, three TV networks, and people ran into each other. People kind of knew each other, and there was a community that seemed kind of close.
Yeah, yeah.
And you grew up in that.
I did. And it's strange because people have asked me so many times, what was it like growing up in that household, you know, where there was Mel Brooks and Sid Caesar and Norman Lear and Larry Gelbart and all this stuff. And I said, you know, when you're a kid, you don't know.
It's just guys.
This is what you have. And it's not until you go over to some of your friends' house, you realize they're not quite as funny over there. It's a little duller.
Right, these are just the guys your dad works with.
It's a little duller at Paul Schindler's house.
At the lawyer's kid's house.
Yeah.
but when was it sort of just an assumption from an early age? You're like, I'm going to be in show business. I'm going to do this.
No, I didn't think of that. I mean, it's interesting. I like to play ball. I love playing baseball. I love playing sports and stuff.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until I got into like my senior year in high school where I said, oh, wait a minute. And I got into a drama class and I said, wait a minute.
Where'd you go to high school?
To Beverly Hills High School.
Right. So that's the high school.
Okay. So here's the kids that were in this drama class. All right.
Yeah.
First of all, Richard Dreyfuss was there. Albert Brooks.
Yeah.
Julie Cobb, who was Lee J. Cobb's daughter.
Oh, he was great.
Melinda Marx, who was Groucho Marx's daughter.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was crazy. But all of a sudden, I said, hey, I like these people. I feel comfortable around these people. They felt familiar. Mm-hmm. And so I said, oh, maybe this is what I do.
Could that have had something to do with the Jewishness of the situation?
Well, there was a Jew-ness.
Yeah.
There was a Jewosity.
What, Groucho's kid was there? Did you see Groucho at events?
No. I saw him at the house, though. He came to our house.
He did.
Yeah, he was at the house. Yeah, we had some. There was some.
He's a little older than your dad, though, right?
Yeah, he was a lot older. Yeah. Steve Allen came over. We had people like that. Yeah.
And then Lee J. Cobb, that guy was something.
Yeah, I can do a perfect Lee J. Cobb imitation.
All right.
Although it probably is not as good on the podcast or radio because you don't see the face. Right. You know.
You want to try?
But 12 Angry Men.
Okay.
I mean, did you see, by the way, Amy Schumer's takeoff of 12 Angry Men?
I did. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How fucking great is that?
It's funny.
Unbelievable.
Very funny.
Jesus was funny. Anyway, Lee J. Cobb and 12 Angry Men. And you'll get a little more of a giggle because you'll see my face.
Okay.
The others won't.
Okay. Everything. Every single thing says he's guilty. What do you think? I'm an idiot or something? The old man saw him right there.
Yeah. Pretty good.
It's very good.
Yeah. It doesn't come in handy because nobody knows who Lee J. Cobb is.
Not anymore.
No.
So when did you start? So you do the acting class. Now, Dreyfuss, I assume he was always like he is.
Yeah, no, he started professionally acting when he was like 13.
With Duddy Kravitz.
Well,
right, or the Graduate.
Even before Duddy Kravitz.
Yeah, one line in The Graduate. Should I call the cops?
I'll call the cops. Should I call the cops? Yeah, but even before that, he was on Sally Field, the Gidget.
Oh, yeah.
And he did Ben Casey, and he did...
So he was a working actor when you were in high school.
He was a working actor. He did theater and all this stuff. Yeah, yeah.
But he wasn't from a show business family, though, was he?
No, no, no.
You like him?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was one of the... my first marriage, I was married to Penny Marshall.
Right.
And he was one of my three best men.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
He was a good man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's a character.
He wasn't the best man. He was a good man.
Oh, he was one of the the side... Who was the best man?
Well, I had... Albert? No, Albert was there, and my other friend, Phil Mishkin.
Yeah. Mishkin's a good Jewish name.
It is.
Yeah. So when did you start acting? When did it happen?
Well, I started... The first job I got, I was an apprentice at the Bucks County Playhouse. I just building sets, painting scenery. And then the next year, out of college, I went and started acting in a company called the Priscilla Beach Theater.
Here in town?
That was in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And
really?
Albert came with me. We were there together.
You and Albert were in a theater group in Massachusetts?
Yes.
He just came out? Like, did he go to college with you, or you just said, this is a thing we're doing this summer?
No, we're going to go this summer. We're going to go.
Was it a prestigious thing? Or
No, it's nothing prestigious at all. All I can tell you is that we lived up in a loft, in a barn area of the loft, and there was no toilet paper. And one of the guys says, this is terrible. I got to wipe my ass with Old Varieties. You know, so it was not luxury at all.
So you just wanted Albert to come out to have the summer camp?
Well, fun. We'll act together. Yeah. We'll do some stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I did that for a while. Then I came back to California. I went to UCLA. And I started
film school?
No, I actually was in the theater school, and I started my own improv group.
Really?
I was friends with some of the people up in the committee in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I used to go up there, and then I started my own group called The Session. Rick Dreyfuss was in it, and a number of other actors. I acted in it and directed it.
Comedy-driven? Comedy,
yeah, comedy. We did a lot of... And then we were together for about a year, and then Larry and I broke off, and we did a double act. We played in clubs. You know, we played like The Hungry Eye. Larry Bishop.
Yeah.
This is Joey Bishop's son.
Yeah.
Larry Bishop. Yeah, Joey. So here's what happened.
You're doing comedy clubs?
Yeah. We got booked into all the clubs. We got booked in Hungry Eye and Mr. Kelly's and Rooster Tail. Detroit,
really?
And Paul.
Mr. Kelly's in Chicago?
Yeah, yeah, all of them. And then Paul's Mall, you know, in Boston.
Bishop and Reiner?
Yeah, Reiner and Bishop, actually.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's okay.
Yeah.
So we get booked in. The first gig we have is in the Hungry Eye in San Francisco. And we're opening for Carmen McRae, who is a really good jazz singer, you know. And in the little room, they had a little room, was Mort Saul. Remember?
Right.
He used to do all the stuff about the
His sweater and his paper.
Yeah, you're right. But he did a whole thing about the Kennedy assassination. That was his big thing.
What year was this that you're talking?
This is 66.
And you're what, 22?
I'm 19 years
19.
old. 19 years old. And we're doing a double act. We open for, and we're getting paid. I mean, we're getting like money, real money. And Larry says to me, he says, Rob, I don't know if I like this.
Yeah.
I said, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
He said, you know, my dad, that's all he ever did. He was in clubs his whole life, Joey Bishop, you know. That's all I said, I don't want to do it. I don't want to be, I said, Larry, we're booked in every club in the country. He said, I'm not doing this anymore, though. I don't want to. So we canceled the whole tour.
You didn't even get to do
No, I didn't get to any of the things. So,
you're booked at Mr. Kelly's.
I was booked everywhere.
And you did one gig?
We did the one gig, and then he said, no, I don't want to do this anymore.
Oh, my God. What did he end up doing, that guy?
Well, he did a lot of biker movies, and he's done some movies.
Directing or acting?
Directing, acting. He's done some stuff with Quentin
Still Taylor. Around?
Yeah, he's still around. So that ended, and then I joined the committee, you know.
Was that Fred Willard, Hessman? Who was the committee?
The committee was Hessman was in it. Lee French, Carl Gottlieb.
Oh, yeah.
Who else was
But not
it?
Willard. Willard was...
No, Willard was not in. He was in... He was with Greco.
Uh-huh.
It was Greco and Willard. And then he joined Ace Trucking Company.
Ace Trucking Company, right.
So I was with the committee. They came to L.A.
Yeah.
And I went in that company. And then Tommy Smothers came in one time, and he hired me and Carl Gottlieb, who eventually went on to write Jaws and The Jerk and stuff. Yeah. And he hired us to write a summer show for Glenn Campbell. It was called The Summer Brothers Smother Show.
Yeah.
And Glenn Campbell was a star, and that's launched his career. And then we worked on the Smothers Brothers for a season.
It's so funny that these guys were Glenn Campbell was a huge star.
Yeah, he was a big star.
And
a big star.
Good guitar player.
the best.
Yeah.
He considered by many the best session guitar player ever.
Yeah.
He played on every rock and roll album.
The Wrecking
Crew. Ever. Yeah, the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
All the Beach Boys stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything, yeah.
So you're working with Tommy and...
Yeah, well, I was writing... I mean, I was the youngest. I was 21 and Steve Martin was 23 and we were kind of thrown together because we were the youngest too. So we wrote
together. You're fucking kids.
Yeah, we were kids.
And did you write with Steve or you just kind of pitched around?
I was paired off with him. We wrote some good sketches. One of the sketches we wrote, here's what would happen. They would throw things out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the day before we were supposed to tape, the censors would come and say, you can't do this.
Yeah.
It's too off the charts. So, you know, Alan Blind, Mason Weaver say, well, who has anything? Does anybody have anything? And I said, well, Steve and I just wrote this thing. It's a satire of a Hollywood premiere. It's like a red carpet, and they interview all the actors. And we did a whole thing. He said, let's hear it. So Steve and I act out the whole thing.
Yeah.
We do the whole thing. All the people laugh, and they love it. And then Alan said, I don't know. I don't think so, no. So it doesn't get on. 2 weeks later, they drop another sketch from the show, and Alan says, wait a minute, what about that Hollywood premiere thing? That was funny.
Yeah.
Let's hear that again. We do the whole thing again. Nah. We did it like 3 or 4 times. They just wanted us to perform. They didn't care. It never got on the air.
But they liked seeing you guys do it?
Yeah, they liked it. But we did write the first fart joke ever done on national television.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. It was Pat Paulson played the guy who was the president of the Acme Novelty Company.
Yeah.
And he was doing, you know, the pucker gum and the hot gum and the dribble glass and everything. And at one point he sits down on a chair and you hear a big like this. And he says, somebody slipped a whoopee cushion in under me. And then he gets up and, of course, there's no whoopee cushion there.
So, that's a big victory.
Big victory for us. Yeah.
So was that? But you didn't want to necessarily be a writer in television.
Well, I mean, that was to me the greatest thing in the world. At the age 21, I could get that job and stuff.
You did a bunch of episodes.
Yeah. Well, we did a whole year.
Yeah.
I mean, a whole year
with the Smothers Brothers.
Yeah.
So so it's you and Steve, and was Martin Mull there?
No, he wasn't there. We had Carl Gottlieb and John. We had so many good. Albert's brother.
Yeah,
Bob Einstein.
Yeah, Bob Einstein. Yeah,
he was there.
And
we had
wow.
a lot of good. Yeah, Murray Roman. We had a lot of good people.
That's amazing. Yeah. So so you really learned how to do it. Get it from the page to the guy.
Yeah, you learn about it. I mean, I had one thing that I it drove me crazy because I wrote a piece. There was a song called, it was Gary Puckett and the Union Gap, and it was a song where he said, are you kissing somebody else? What was the song? Damn it, I can't remember it. Woman, woman, have you got cheating on your mind? That was cheating.
Yeah.
And so I said, here's the thing, Tommy. You're with this girl, and you're singing the song to her, and while you're singing, a guy is just tonguing your girlfriend. Just tonguing. And he said, yeah, but I would see it. I said, but that's the joke. The joke is that you're singing and asking her, have you got cheating on your mind? And she's right there doing it.
Yeah.
And he says, no, but that's it. So now it goes on the air. Now we're shooting it. And every time he said, have you got cheating on your mind? He'd look the other way and the guy would be kissing her. And then when he turned back, he wouldn't be kissing
her.
I said, and then after the thing, he says, see, it didn't work. I said, it didn't work because you didn't do what I told you to do. You got to kiss her while she's saying cheating. Anyway. When you're a young kid, they don't listen to you.
The way that you get excited, I can't imagine that when you and Albert Brooks talk, that anybody, like people must be just sitting around going like, oh my God.
Well, here's the thing. Well, here's the thing about Albert. Albert is the funniest human being I've ever met in my life. And when he starts... you clear out. It's like a challenge dance. Everybody goes and does.
Yeah.
But when Albert starts, everybody stops.
Yeah.
And I've been in groups with Robin Williams and Chevy Chase, Blue. I don't care who's there.
Yeah.
They all stop to listen to Albert. And I'll remember one time, I'll never forget, he started in, they stopped. It was at a party.
Yeah.
And just killed. I mean, just killed. And then he finished, right? He finished. And then he left. He left the party. About 20 minutes later, the hostess of the party calls me over and says, Albert's on the phone. I said, what? What? I get on the phone. I said, Albert, what's up? What's up? He says, listen, you got to do me a favor. I said, what? He said, I left my keys in the house, in the apartment there. I can't come back. I can't come back and get them. Can you just get me my keys and bring them down to me? He had finished his performance. He wouldn't go back. So I got the keys and I brought it to him. Yeah.
He had his big exit.
Oh, no, he couldn't come back. He couldn't go back.
It was the right move.
Yeah. No, Albert's the most brilliant person I ever did. He did a routine once on The Tonight Show. He played a mime.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you ever saw it, but he was in whiteface.
Yeah.
And he had a leotard, a black leotard. And he comes out and he never stops talking. The entire time. He just says, look here, I pulled a rope. You cannot see the rope. There's no rope here, but I am pulling anyway. And it was brilliant, you know? But it got no laughs. Everybody thought, you know, it's just like the worst mime ever, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, no laughs. Yeah. So now 2 weeks later, my dad was subbing for Carson that night. The next 2 weeks, they call him. They say, Albert, do you want to come back on The Tonight Show? And he said, and by the way, he never tried out any of his routines in a club.
Right.
He just put them on the air. That was it.
Yeah.
So next 2 weeks, and I said, Albert, what are you going to do? And he says, I'm going to do the mime piece. I said, what are you, crazy? He said, the mime piece, you got no laughs. He said, it's funny. I said, I know it's funny, but nobody laughed.
Right.
So he said, I'm doing it. He goes on. He starts the exact same piece with the talking and the thing. And Carson, and again, nobody's laughing at the top. All of a sudden, Carson starts to giggle. And now the audience sees.
Yeah, right,
that
right.
That they're digging it, you know, and the place explodes.
He did it twice in a month?
Same thing within a month. And what?
But your dad wasn't hosting.
No, that was Carson. Carson had never seen the bit.
Oh, your dad.
So had seen the bit.
Oh, right.
So he knew what it was.
Right.
Carson had never seen it. He starts to laugh, and he literally fell off his chair, and the audience got the cue.
Oh, that's insane.
And so it taught me a lesson that, you know, sometimes you got to just stay with, if it's funny.
And also, like, the fact is that if they were taking it seriously, he allowed them to realize that.
Yes.
They did, but it's so funny at that point in time that they didn't trust Johnny enough to know that he didn't hire the worst mime in the world.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, how stupid do people got to be? So when do you start doing the All in the Family?
Well, I was, like I said, I was like 21 when I did
Smothers.
Smothers, and then I was like 23. I started writing for Andy Griffith. He had a show. No, this was after the Andy Griffith
Variety show.
It was a sitcom called The Headmaster.
Yeah.
He played a headmaster of like a progressive high school.
Yeah.
And I wrote for that.
Yeah.
And I auditioned for All in the Family, and Norman liked it. He saw this episode that I wrote. I actually acted in.
Yeah.
And he gave me a part. I was only 23 at the time when we started. 24 when
it's amazing how young you guys were. When you were in the business. I mean, it was happening.
Yeah.
And so with how long did it take for that to gel
Well, the thing about it is when it first came on the air, CBS was like, there was like disclaimers, you know, basically, you know, like, we don't, you know, there's the views on this show do not reflect the attitudes of the network.
And really?
So, basically, it said, you know, if you want to watch this, you know, we don't have anything to do with it. You do whatever you want. You watch it, but we don't really. They didn't promote it or anything.
Uh-huh.
And then it was on for 13 weeks, and then 13 weeks over the summer, and after 26 weeks, people picked up on it.
Then it took that long.
Then it went through the roof. Yeah.
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 And did you like the comedy on that was so beautiful?
Yeah.
All of it was so. The relationships were so beautiful.
Yeah. And that was what was great about it. I mean, it was real. It was honest. I mean, we were arguing about all the issues that were, you know, of the day, the Vietnam War, the racism. I mean, it was all, we did everything.
Yeah. And what was your relationship like with Norman?
Good.
Yeah?
Good. He knew me from the time I was
a kid. Yeah.
A little kid. Yeah.
Well, did you learn things from him or in terms of like comedy and how to balance
stuff?
Well,
what I learned from him, the most important thing I learned from him is to go as far as you can with something. In other words, don't accept, dig further, go deeper, make it make it edgier. Do more. I mean, he like I said, he's got the biggest set of balls of anybody I know in the show business. And I got that you can push it.
You can
really push it. It was beyond the edge of the envelope. I mean, we were way outside the envelope.
Because, the envelope was smaller and the war and stuff. Like, you know, what was going on in Hollywood? Because you're at that age, you know, you were draftable, right?
Yeah.
And then what happened with your peer group? And I mean, everything in show business is changing. Your father's generation doesn't necessarily know what the hell's happening anymore.
Yeah, no, my father marched in the moratorium against the war. My mother was part of this group, Another Mother for Peace. They wrote, she helped design this poster, War is Unhealthy for Children and Other Living Things. That was a very big thing during that time. But I mean, the war was divided the country. And, we could have gotten killed. I mean, you know, my Dreyfus became a conscientious objector. There were guys I knew that went to Canada, others that went to jail. It was a tough time.
Yeah. And you were on that show. So you were confronting all that stuff.
Yeah.
That was 7 years.
Yeah.
And what
eight years. Yeah.
And what'd you learn about from Carol O'Connor as an actor, I imagine?
Well, I learned a lot from him, which is if you have a good script, if you have a good story, you don't have to do anything with your face. I mean, in other words, let the story support what you have to do, and the audience will read in whatever they need to read in.
Right.
You don't have to. It's only when you got a weak script and a weak story that you're doing, you know, acting pyrotechnics in order to make it kind of work.
Right, and he was such a great slow burn guy.
Oh, fabulous, fabulous, fabulous. One time, this is great.
Yeah.
One time I'm in a scene with him, and we're in, and I can't remember why, but I was in bed. I was in bed with him, and he's facing away from me.
Yeah,
and I knock this jug of water on the side of the bed, and it goes into the bed, and it hits him right.
Yeah,
and he turns around and looks at me like, "Did you just fucking piss in this bed?"
Yeah,
you know, like this. Yeah. He turns around and looks at me like this. And he just keeps looking at me, you know, like this. And the camera's over my shoulder looking at him. And I'm starting to go. I'm starting to go. And he keeps looking at me. And under my breath, I'm saying, "I'm so sorry, Carol." I'm going like this because I couldn't stop.
Yeah. You were going to laugh?
Yeah, I had to go, yeah. Because he just kept looking at me and like, "What did you do in this bed?"
So now when you guys show up in movies, like after a certain point, like when you do a little bit in The Jerk, or you do, you know, you show up in, as an actor.
Yeah.
Is people know you, right? They're like, "Rob, will you come do this? Or do you got to go audition for shit?"
Well, I mean, I've gotten to a point now where, you know, I get called once in a while. You know, I did this Wolf of Wall Street a year or so ago.
Right, The Father.
Yeah, that was fun. And every once in a while I do something. And it's fun because, there's no responsibility.
Scorsese asked for you?
Yeah, they ask. They say to come and do it. And so I will always go. I mean, listen, if Scorsese says to do it, you do it. You know, I mean, you don't wait around. But I mean, I like it because I don't have a responsibility. I mean, you just go as an actor. You don't, when you're directing, you got all the pain in the world. I remember years ago, Ronnie Howard called me to do, there was a thing called EdTV. Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey, Ellen DeGeneres was in it. And he said, "There's a part here. If you want, maybe you could read, read it and see if it's something you're interested in." And I said, "Well, I don't have to read it. I mean, I'll do it, whatever it is."
Yeah.
I said, "If it stinks, it's not my fault."
So what now? The first movie they directed was Spinal Tap, right?
Right.
Now that thing, you knew all those guys.
Yeah, yeah, we were all friends. We'd all done stuff together.
Right, and what was the? How'd you conceive of that?
Well, here's what happened. I did a special for ABC.
Yeah,
and back I think it was 1978 or 79, something like that. And the whole special was an hour of satire of different things on television.
Right.
This was before SCTV, but it was a similar kind of thing. A man sitting in a chair just flipping from one chair. There'd be a sitcom, there'd be a commercial.
Oh, I see.
You know, yeah.
So the device was the guy flipping.
Yeah, to flipping, and we'd make fun.
Right.
And one of the things we did was a takeoff of Midnight Special, which was a late night rock and roll
show. Kirshner.
Don Kirshner. And it was Wolfman Jack, and I played Wolfman. "Baby, did hear the Wolf." You know, I did the Wolfman Jack thing. And I introduced, for the first time, Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
This, we're England's loudest band.
Yeah.
And they came on, they did a thing called Rock and Roll Nightmare.
Was
and
it the guys?
Was yeah, it was the guys.
Okay.
It was Chris and Harry and Michael, but it was also, we had Loudon Wainwright on keyboards, and we had Russ Kunkel, great, great drummer,
drummer
played
yeah.
for Linda Ronstadt and the Eagles right. and all these, you know,
great, Hollywood guys.
Jackson Brown.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they did it, and Chris and Harry and Michael started just improvising in these characters
yeah.
while we were doing it. I said, geez, it would be great to somehow do something with these characters beyond this
yeah.
one little piece that we did. And then Harry and I had an idea for a movie called Roadie. And, you know, just what was it like to be backstage, you know, the roadies on a rock and roll tour. Then the movie called Roadie came out with
right.
Meatloaf.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so we said, ah, forget that.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Chris and
Michael,
they had done a thing where they played two rock and roll guys who meet each other in a hotel room, and they can't remember whether or not they played in a band together, and they're kind of drugged out and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
And we look at that, and we said, hey, let's all get together, and we'll make a thing out of this. And with it, so that's what we did. And I went to a company, and I asked them to give us the money to write a screenplay. We start to write the screenplay. We realized there's no way we can convey in screenplay form what this is going to be. So
right.
I said, give me the money you were going to give me for the screenplay. I'll make a little of the movie. So I made like 20 minutes with interview footage and backstage and concert stuff. And I showed it to them. And they said, nah, we don't like this.
Yeah.
And so it took a couple of years to, you know, walk in, going around town to get them somebody to be interested to make it.
And finally, they
did. And then we finally got to make it.
But there's this mythology around it that, like, Reiner had 60 hours.
Oh, we had. I'll tell you what we had. The first cut that we put together was 4.5 hours, not including 3 hours of interview footage.
Right.
Because I interviewed them all over.
So you did shoot a lot.
Oh, God. We shot. I mean, we shot, you know, it took me 9 months to cut the thing because we basically edited it because it's all improvised. The whole film is
improvised.
Now,
was that the first time that was ever done? That an entire movie was improvised?
I don't think anybody's ever done that. I don't know that they have.
And then it sort of set this standard in terms of, like, I think that was the thing that really informed Christopher Guest movies around
yeah.
improvising.
Well, Chris did all those improvised movies.
And then you have these TV shows now, like Larry.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do the improvising.
Kurt, yeah.
But it seems like that Spinal Tap was really the first
yeah.
template for
yeah.
taking that risk
yeah.
and giving it context.
Yeah, and it was funny because we, you know, we had a, you know, a whole outline was 4 pages.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know. And so we tried different things. And one of the things we had a group opening for Spinal Tap called The Dose.
Yeah.
And it was like a, you know, punk band.
Yeah.
And it was Sherry Curie
yeah.
and, you know, from The Runaways and stuff. And and if you remember in Spinal Tap, there's a shot where you see there's the kind of a herpes sore
yeah.
on Michael and Chris.
Yeah.
They're together, and people laugh at it. They know it. That was the remnants of a joke that took an hour to set up. Basically, you see the Dose opening for Spinal Tap, and
yeah.
the next shot, Chris is with Sherry Curie, and the next thing you know, he's got a herpes
right.
sore on his lip.
Yeah.
Then she's with Michael. He's got a herpes sore.
Right.
Then he's with Harry. They're passing her around. She keeps getting herpes. Now there's a band meeting. They're all sitting around. Four guys with herpes sores, and the drummer, the only one without the herpes sore. And they said, yeah, I think we got to drop the Dose from the tour. And the drummer says, no, I like them. I think we should keep them. It took an hour to tell that joke. So that we lost that.
But it worked so good.
Yeah.
Just without the unspoken
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you just see two guys with herpes sores.
It was perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
But who was making those decisions? You?
Well, yeah, I mean, we all did. You know,
yeah.
the four of us.
You sat and edited
yeah,
together?
No, I was the one who was in the editing
yeah.
room with, but I would put together something and then I'd show it to the guys and we'd all talk about it. Then I'd go back and work on it. But it really was a collaboration, the four of us.
But you never thought to do anything with the footage that you didn't use?
Well, you know, in these DVDs and
it's
you
around.
Know, they put
yeah,
it,
yeah,
there's,
yeah.
there's a scene with Bruno Kirby where he gets,
right.
they get him high and he,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
he's singing My Way.
Yeah, something. Yeah, right, right.
He's a big Sinatra fan.
So once you got the handle on the directing thing, you wanted to do bigger movies, scripted
well,
movies?
Well, I always wanted to direct. That's the thing that I always wanted to do. So, yeah, I mean, people would always say to me, I don't understand how you could make your first movie could be a movie with no script, you
yeah.
know? And I said, well, but that's what I feel comfortable doing. I mean,
yeah.
I've my whole life, I grew up improvising, and that's yeah. what I do. But it was harder to do a scripted.
Why? Because you had to learn how to...
Well, you got to know where to put the camera and what the lights do and everything.
The basics.
Yeah, exactly.
But the sure thing that kind of made John Cusack, right?
Well, yeah, he was 17 years old when we first did that,
And then he did Cameron Crowe's movie, and that blew it up, right?
Yeah.
But Stand By Me was huge.
Yeah, that one was big, but didn't know. I mean, you know, we start out, it was four 12-year-olds. Who knows if that's
going to... Why'd you decide that? What, did you like the story?
Well,
what?
Here's what I liked. The writing, I mean, it was based on a Stephen King short story called The Body.
Yeah.
And when I read the script, I thought, wow, that the writing is great. These characters are great. The time frame, I loved 1959. I was 12 years old. Yeah. So that was the thing. And then I didn't really know what the focus of it was. And it was when I figured out that it was about Gordy's character. Because in the short story, he's just an observer. He's like one of the four. When I made him the focus, and that his whole thing about feeling like his father didn't care about him because his father had lost the son and cared more about his brother, that's when it started becoming more connected to me. And I started feeling, okay, I can tell this story.
And then he's a writer.
He's a writer, and it had a sensibility, which is, you know, there's humor in it, but there's also a melancholy feel, which is the way, my personality.
With some of the struggles the kids were going through.
Yes.
Now, like something like that, when you got Dreyfuss there as the narrator and then the guy you see at the end, is that just one of those things where you call Richard up and go, hey, you want to do this?
Well, what happened was I had somebody else doing it, and it wasn't quite right. It wasn't that the actor was good, but the voice and the voiceover didn't. So I tried a few other voices, and then finally I called Rick up and I said, hey, would you do the voice? And he said, yeah, I'll do the voice, but if you want, I'll reshoot it for you and I'll be the guy.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And that was a friendly thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, you guys know each other forever. Yeah. And The Princess Bride was an amazing movie. Everyone loves that movie. It's a fairy tale with all that comedy, all those great people in it.
Yeah,
Billy's in it. Mandy Patinkin, the guy who's in the new movie.
Yeah, Cary Elwes.
Yeah,
being Charlie.
Yeah, you wanted to do a fairy tale. Or that? How did that come?
Well, that was because I was a huge William Goldman fan. I had read every book that he had ever written, from Temple of Gold, My Turn to Curtsy, Your Turn to Bow, Boys and Girls Together. So I loved it. And my dad did a play on Broadway in 1968.
What was that?
It was called Something Different.
Yeah.
And Bill wrote a book about that season on Broadway called The Season.
Yeah.
And he became friends with my dad. And when he finished Princess Bride, he gave it to my dad.
Yeah.
He said, what do you think about this? My dad said, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know what to do. But he said, he gave it to me. I was in my 20s at the time. He said, here, you like William Goldman, why don't you read this book? I read the book, and it was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is like, you know, when you read something, and it feels like the person's writing for you.
Yeah.
It's like your sensibility. I said, wow, this is incredible. And so when I started making films, I started to my friend Andy. I said, hey, they make movies out of books, don't they? What about this? I'll make a movie. And I said, let's see if anybody's ever tried to make a movie out of Princess Bride. I found out at that point that, yes, they had,
optioned it.
You know, it was Francois Truffaut,
right?
Norman Jewison, Redford. I mean, they all tried to do it, and nobody could do it. And I said, oh, let's see if maybe William Goldman would let me talk to him. So I was able to get a meeting with him, and he said yes.
Yeah, do it. Try it.
Yeah.
But you found the humor in it all the way through.
Well, it's there. I mean, that was there in the book. I mean,
who else is going to make it as funny as you, though?
Well, I don't know.
The guys you just mentioned, those aren't funny guys.
Somebody could do.
But like your father, like directed, he did a lot of movies, starting with Where's Poppin', and then he did The Jerk, too, right?
Right, right.
So you were on set, in terms of learning how to use the camera,
I was there for the Van Dyke Show.
Yeah.
My dad did the Dick Van Dyke Show, and it's very famous. You know, I did grab Mary Tyler Moore by the ass.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that? Well, now it's important that
you
do.
What did you do?
Well, I was 14 years old, and I saw her, and she was wearing those. She was like 24, 25. Yeah. She wore those capri pants.
Yeah.
And I was, my hormones were going crazy. She writes about it. I'm not telling tales out of school because she did write about it in her book and told a story on Letterman and all that. I grabbed her ass, And my father calls me into his office.
Yeah.
She told on me.
Yeah.
I said, did you grab Mary Tyler Moore by the ass? I said, yeah, I did. He says, don't ever do that again. He had a big smile on his face, though. I gotta tell you. Yeah.
He was happy that you did.
Yeah, something,
So you saw how your father worked.
Yeah, he didn't grab her on the ass.
I'm the only one.
That's the only one I did by myself.
That was different from what his career.
Yeah, did you explain that you were improvising? But I mean, in terms of learning how to direct. I mean,
yes, I saw how he worked. Yes, definitely. I learned it at his knee and all that.
And he was a gracious director, and you know.
Well, he was. It was his show. I mean, I saw how he worked with the actors, how he changed the script.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I watched how they staged the cameras. I did the same thing on All in the Family.
But when he directed you in a couple of movies, how was that experience?
It was fine. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, it's fine. It's weird. You know, it's weird.
Because like, if my kid's gonna do a thing, there's always got to be that feeling. Like, he's bringing his kid. It's good that you're funny.
Yeah,
it'd be bad if you were a shitty kid.
I know, that'd be terrible.
And then, all right, so Harry Met Sally.
Right.
That was huge.
Big hit.
Yeah, your mother's line, big.
My mother's line, to me, was one of the great thrills of my life, that my mother, who says, I'll have what she's having, that line is considered one of the top 10 lines
in
movie history.
Yeah.
You know, they talk, you know, it's like, frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn, and Louis, this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And so they got, you know, Bogart and Clark Gable, and Estelle Reiner is in there with them, you know, so...
Then you go off to sort of a different journey with Misery, which I loved. I love that movie.
Yeah, that was a fun one for me to make.
Well, James Caan is like, you kind of, like, it was like this new thing. Like, he was getting old. He'd been, he'd been a little out of the game. And then he comes in this sort of, like, humbled kind of. Like,
I know. What I liked about it is he's this really physical guy, and that he would be stuck in that bed.
Did you like working with him?
I did. Every day I came up to the set, I'd come up to him and I said, Billy, I said, okay, now, Jimmy, here's the thing. In this scene, you're in bed. I said that to him every day. He kept looking like I was going to give him some words of wisdom.
Yeah.
No, see, Jimmy, in this scene, you're in bed. I said that to him every day.
Did he laugh?
Yeah.
I have no sense of what he's really like. Yeah. He's such a big presence.
Yeah. He's Sonny. He's Sonny Corleone.
I know.
He got shot on the causeway.
Yeah, I know. You can't. He never. Freebie and the Bean. I love that movie.
Yeah.
You know, like James Caan is like this guy, the gambler.
Yeah.
And then to see him as this older guy, you got him all scared.
Yeah.
Of this woman, Kathy Bates, that made her right.
She was great. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Did she win an Oscar or anything?
Yeah,
for that?
She won an Oscar.
That's exciting.
Yeah, it was fun.
Do you have Oscars?
No.
Right. What do you want me?
Do you
want
to give me one?
Sure.
I've been nominated for Oscar, but I didn't win an Oscar.
That's annoying.
I know. It's really annoying.
Maybe you have to wait out for the Lifetime Achievement.
And I think they should do it before you. See, that was the other thing I was thinking as I watched As I watched the thing last night. They should have, like, memorial services, like, when you're alive. Because what good is it? Gary Shandling, there were some big laughs there last night. Yeah. Gary didn't hear any of them.
Yeah.
Why don't you do
Depends what you believe, but yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, let's put it this way. Even if you believe that there's an afterlife and a heaven, he's not hearing it exactly the way it was. You know, it's filtered.
Yeah.
It's filtered through a lot of stuff.
But
the point is, wouldn't it be great if he could be around and hearing all that before he goes?
Yeah, it would be.
I think we're onto something.
And A Few Good Men, great. It's got one of my favorite moments in movies.
Which is, you can't handle the
truth. Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was from the play, right?
That's from the play, yeah.
And working with Jack Nicholson, was that a nervous thing? I mean,
Jack is like the greatest actor for a director because he gives it his all all the time.
Uh-huh.
When he showed up in the table read, there's a lot of young actors in that, you know, there's Tom Cruise and
Kevin Bacon,
Kevin Pollak. And, you know, a lot of Demi Moore. Yeah. I mean, a lot of good young actors.
Yeah.
And when he sits down at the table read, he reads it like it's a performance.
Right.
It sends a message to everybody that we're here to really do the work. I liken it like to, you're taking batting practice and everybody's hitting the ball, and then all of a sudden Babe Ruth steps in the cage and starts banging them into the seats, and you go, oh, okay.
Yeah,
I
and
see
you
what
felt
this,
that, right?
I see
right
what
at the table
is.
Read?
Yeah, I see what this
and
is.
And like Tom Cruise was like, holy shit.
Everybody said, we better step up our game. And I remember when he did that famous speech where he does that, you can't handle the truth. We have a lot of angles, and I said to Jack, I said, look, we can do one of two things. Either I can shoot you first.
Yeah.
And, or I can shoot all of the reactions.
Yeah.
And I'll save you, if you want to rehearse during. He said, why don't you shoot the reactions? And that way, by the time you turn around and shoot me, I'll be ready.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we're shooting, reactions for Tom Cruise and Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
And he giving this, full out performance every time. Every time. And at one point I go up to Jack. I said, Jack, you know, maybe you should take it easy. I mean, because we're going to come around to you. And he says, Rob, you don't understand. I love to act. And he just likes to do that.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good moment,
yeah,
huh?
Yeah.
So, but how do you choose, man? So you decide to take on Race. You do Ghost of Mississippi, and that was a heavy movie. That was the Medgar Evers movie, right?
Right, right.
Which I saw. And it was like, you know, you have a lot of range, but you do bring a certain point of view to the movies, and you have a directing style that I can identify.
Yeah, but, you know, I think also as I've gotten older, you know, I'm learning more. It's odd to say, because I just turned 69, and I'm still making movies. I made two this year. I'm going to make another one. And I'm learning more and more. And as I go along, I think I get better. My skills get better. I figure out more about what I know.
What about economy or about vision?
Oh. Yes, both. Both. Yeah. You know, your vision begets. You know, it's a conglomeration of everything you've taken in on your life.
Yeah.
You know, see it, and then all of a sudden you find it going out on the page in the script.
Right.
Just experiences you had and knowledge and information and all this stuff, and it gets out there.
Now, when you do a movie, is it always something that you want to do, that you initiate, or are you ever hired to direct?
The only time I ever did anything that I didn't want, you know, that I didn't initiate, was a movie called Rumor Has It. And it's with Jennifer Aniston and Kevin Costner, Shirley MacLaine, and Mark Ruffalo. And the only reason I did it as a favor because they had had they had started shooting and they shut the movie down.
Uh-huh.
And my friend Alan Horn, who was he was the time running Warner Brothers, who was my partner in forming Castle Rock, he called and said, "We're in trouble, and could you come and help? Could you come and do it?" And so I said, "Yeah, okay."
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like. Yeah. You know, it was an exercise.
Uh huh.
Yeah,
that's a very diplomatic thing to say, right?
Yeah. Well, Kevin Costner says to me, he said, "You're like a guy who came in and looked at the garage, and it's a mess. This what the heck?" And say, "Okay, we're gonna put the paint cans over here. We're gonna hang the bicycle over here. The tools are gonna go."
Yeah, put it all
together.
Try
to fix it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the bucket list, I saw that too. How did that happen? I saw the bucket list.
The bucket list was just a script that came in over the transom. I had turned 60, and I started thinking about, you know, my mortality.
Right.
When I turned 60, I thought of myself as a very, very, very young old person.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're the beginnings of being old.
Yeah.
And I started thinking about, you know, life and the things that you want to do with your life and how, you know. So that came along at that time, and I went, okay.
And you got to work with Jack again?
Jack, yeah.
He and that was fun?
And Morgan Freeman, who I love.
Yeah.
Both of them. I mean, Morgan is like, you know, the nicest, easiest actor I ever worked with.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's like, he probably just turns it on. And
he does. And what's weird about Morgan is he's the fastest study I've ever worked with. I mean, you can give him something, because every morning we'd go in the trailer and we'd rewrite the scene, you know, whatever the scene was. And we'd hand it to Morgan. He'd take one look and he said, "Okay, I got it."
Yeah.
And that was it.
So now there's two questions I want to ask. LBJ's not out yet, right?
No. LBJ, we're hoping to come out.
Is that based on the play?
No. The play, they're doing an HBO special that's based on the play.
With Cranston?
Bryan Cranston. I think comes out in May.
Yeah.
And hopefully ours will come out at the end of the year, before the election, but it's with Woody Harrelson.
As LBJ.
As LBJ.
What years?
It takes place, for the most part, for the time he's picked as vice president until the assassination, and he assumes the presidency and delivers that famous speech in the House of Representatives about continuing Kennedy's legacy. And there's some flashback to when he was majority leader prior to that, but it's a small sliver of time. And Woody Harrelson, it's just off the charts how good he is.
He's pretty astounding.
Well, but you won't believe when you see this. I mean, he becomes this character, and there were days I would watch it and I would forget, and I would go, "Oh my God!" It's like it's Will Johnson.
Wow.
He's there, and it's like weird. It was weird.
It's all shot.
Yeah, it's finished.
Really?
It's finished. Yeah. Matter of fact, this week we're showing it to distributors for the first time.
Really?
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Now, tell me just, you know, we can kind of close off on this. Now, the creation of Castle Rock as a production company.
Mm-hmm.
Because you did pretty good with that.
Yeah. I mean, we started in 1987. There were the five of us.
Yeah.
And we, you know, up till now, we've done over 125 movies.
Yeah.
And the Seinfeld, of course, you know, we did that.
So
and
now how does that work with that? So you were the producer or one of the producers. Your production company did yeah. Seinfeld.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so that's money forever.
Hopefully.
Because I met with them. I had a deal with the NBC on a pilot years ago, and Castle Rock was a production company.
Right.
And you guys had done Seinfeld, or maybe it was just over, maybe it was the last season or two. And mine went nowhere. But I remember being excited to meet, who were the guys over there? Glenn? Was it Glenn?
Glenn Padnick, yeah.
And Richie Rosenstock.
Right.
Those were the guys
yeah,
I met.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were talking, it was going to
yeah.
be great.
Yeah.
Nothing happened.
That's upset.
You need... It wasn't that great a thing.
Do you need money?
No, I'm all right.
You okay? You're all right?
No, no. I was a chef. It was not a great script.
Yeah.
But
right.
What are you going to do? I didn't understand television.
Well, listen, you don't know. We did a pilot prior to that with Howie Mandel.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jerry Seinfeld auditioned for that, and we decided to go with Howie Mandel, and that didn't work. It went like 13 episodes.
Yeah.
And then George Shapiro, you know, who's Jerry's manager,
yeah.
he said, well, we have an idea with Larry David, you know, come in and, you know, and so that's how that happened.
Yeah.
I mean, it was because we had seen Jerry do
yeah,
it. Of
yeah.
course, we thought he, you know, he was a stand-up. I didn't know he was interested in doing, you know.
Right. You he know. Had no idea.
Yeah.
And
and you never know if it's going to be successful.
Sure. But do you, how much of a part do you have in the day-to-day with that stuff?
I didn't have any. I was, my biggest part was convincing Brandon Tartikoff not to throw it off the air. I had to go in and make the most impassioned plea.
You did?
Yes, I did.
And it, did you pace? Did you
well,
sit?
Well, I screamed a lot.
And really?
I
told you got to him, that
well,
level?
I was pretty hot because I said, this is the best show that you will ever have. And if you reject it, you're turning your back on one of the funniest creative shows you ever. And he said, I can't have a show, you know, at that time it was called The Show About Nothing, you
yeah.
know. I mean, they had an episode where they sat around and waiting for a table at a Chinese restaurant.
Yeah.
And he said, I can't have a show where that's all they do is sit around waiting for a table at a Chinese restaurant. There's got to be things, there's got to be stories, there's got to be stuff. And I said, I promise you there'll be. And then I finally convinced him, he said, okay. And then I go to Larry and I said, Larry, we got to have stories. We need stories. He says, you want to turn this into the fucking Lucy show? I said, no, Larry, it's not going to be the Lucy show. And he said, it's your sensibility. No matter what, it's going to be yours,
yeah.
and you're going to be able to yeah. do it. And then, of course, Larry, you know, once he discovered the idea of story, it was like, hey, this is great.
It was not on his...
And boy, did he have... He had intertwined things hooking up to other things. It was like all of a sudden he had reinvented... He was so happy.
But he had not conceived of that before.
Not initially. He thought it would just be two guys hanging out, talking to... You know, like he and Jerry would do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that was certainly part of it. That was a big part of it.
Yeah.
But then these
yeah.
other things
and
came
And the stories
in.
Became so...
They unbelievable. Yeah.
And when did that happen? When you had done the pilot or it had been on?
No, it had been on. It had been on a little while and they were going to throw it off.
Oh, and you stepped in.
I stepped in.
And Larry had an epiphany.
Larry, yeah, he did. It took him a while. But then if you look at Curb Your Enthusiasm, I mean, how great is that?
Yeah.
And it's story up the yin yang.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know.
Have you been in one of those?
Yeah, I did one.
Well, I'm trying to remember.
I did. I think it was in like in the first or second
year. As yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I basically run into him in the waiting room of a psychiatrist's office, and I say, you know, I try to convince him to auction himself off for a charity
lunch. Right. Yeah.
Groat syndrome.
Yeah.
The equivalent of drinking 10 cups of coffee every hour.
Right. And you guys are buddies, kind of?
Yeah. No, he's a great guy. Larry's, he's brilliant.
Sweet guy.
Yeah, brilliant.
Well, man, I like that you guys are all friends. It makes me feel better.
Yeah.
Anything you want to talk about?
Well, just Being Charlie is coming out May 6th.
Then that's a different kind of movie for you.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, there's humor in it, but it's pretty dark in a lot of places.
I like that the kid's stand-up was okay. That actor handled it okay.
He did it okay, yeah.
He did. Yeah, it's hard to do.
It's hard to do.
Not a comedian.
But he's not a comedian.
Right.
And I had to work with him and get him to... You
but
know.
He's an open micer, you know. It's,
yeah.
You're not
it's
assuming.
Open mic. Yeah. He's also 18 years old.
Yeah.
You know, so he's just starting out. He's trying to.
Yeah.
Trying to get us to see.
Well, it's a heavy movie, and it was well done, and it was honest, and I appreciated
it. Thanks.
And I'm glad your son's okay, and it was an honor and a thrill talking
thanks.
To you.
Thanks. You see, nobody knows, but we're shaking hands right now.
I know, it just happened.
I know.
Thanks, Rob.
All right.
How great was that? What is he? He's Rob Reiner. Come on. He's like in our hearts and minds. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get tickets to my Trippany House shows through the months of May and June, Tuesdays. Nice, cheap ticket. Some good times. Is my guitar on? Oh, it's on. Yeah. Stay open, people. That's one thing I learned from that. From that Shanling Memorial, among other things. Try to stay open. Stay open, stay present. This might be it. This might be it.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.